From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Was 2006 a good year, a bad year, or a middling year for movies? You'll hear what Sacramento's top film critics think as we remember the year's cinematic highlights and lowlights today on Insight. Plus, a woman who kept an audio journal of a year spent fighting breast cancer.
I am in the waiting room, in the pre-op, waiting to have a double mastectomy.
Dina Howard's remarkable story is told in a KXJZ News documentary that premieres tonight. On Insight, you'll meet Dina, her surgeon, and the documentary's co-producer. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the movies of 2006. We'll talk about the year's best and worst. But first,
1 week ago today, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Infiltrating ductal carcinoma is what the doctor said.
That's the voice of Dina Howard at the beginning of a remarkable year-long audio diary she kept of her cancer diagnosis and treatment. The many hours of tape she recorded have been distilled into a powerful documentary. Dina's Diary, as the program is called, will air soon on the station. Today on Insight, you'll meet Dina. We'll also talk with a surgeon and the producer who crafted the program out of her diary. Dina Howard, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Why did you decide to record what must have been one of the toughest, maybe even the toughest year of your life?
Mostly for two reasons, I suppose. The first is because I like to have a project. It's good for me to focus on something. And I knew that this year was going to be very, very much about treatment. And I wasn't going to be able to do a lot of outside work. So that was the first reason. The second reason is because I needed to have something positive come out of what otherwise could have been a very negative experience. And I didn't know going into it what the eventual result would be in terms of the piece. But I certainly hoped that something positive and interesting would be created.
People often feel vulnerable when they have a serious illness. And it's tempting perhaps to retreat into one's shell. But I read something you wrote for our website in connection to the documentary. You wrote, "It soon became clear to me what my assignment had to be. When I was most afraid, it was time to turn on the tape recorder. It's one thing to have that assignment, but it's another thing to do it." What did it feel like when you actually felt afraid and turned on the recorder?
Honestly, I think at times the fear was so great that the recorder was almost irrelevant. And if anything, it calmed me down because it gave me something to focus on that was outside of myself and my most immediate circumstances. I also knew that it wasn't like live radio. I knew that there would be an editing process. So I thought if anything was just too raw or too inappropriate, I have a good enough relationship with Paul, and I really trust Paul. Paul's the producer of the piece along with me. I knew that he would respect any boundaries I later created, and that gave me a real freedom, I think, to just go for it.
Did you record anything that you later decided was too raw or inappropriate, as you said?
I don't think so. I think we pretty much left it all up for grabs. It was
early in the program. We are with you at a beach in Santa Barbara. This is the day after Thanksgiving 2005, and you're starting to reflect on what you think is coming up in the year ahead. Let's hear a bit of this.
I think I had some really, really healthy denial going on. All of a sudden, here I am at this cancer center, and the doctors were incredible and the nurses were incredible, but there were lots of patients, and kind of felt like I went from zero to cancer patient in no time flat. I'm gonna stop here and listen to the waves for a moment, see if you can hear them. The waves are beautiful. Ah, I'm about to get hit. Hold on. I'm going to stand under the pier and we're going to listen to the waves for a moment. They're so beautiful.
They're so beautiful. So here's my goal. Next year, 1 year from today, day after Thanksgiving, to be on the same beach, done with all this stuff.
What's it like today, listening back to Dina, not knowing what was ahead of her and trying to be brave and cheerful where possible?
It's hard. I have a box of Kleenex next to me right now because I wasn't sure I could even make it through this interview without tearing up. When I first contacted Paul sort of after I felt I had completed the project, after I'd completed the majority of my treatment, I actually had him listen to everything first. I said, I'm not at a place yet where I can sit down and listen to this and re-experience the year. I need to hand it off to you. And he did the first pass because it did feel a bit overwhelming.
Paul Conley's with us. He's senior producer at KXJZ News, and he actually assembled the documentary that was constructed out of Dina Howard's audio diary. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Jeffrey.
How did you set about approaching all this material, hours of material, to make a program out of it?
A lot of listening, just a lot of listening and absorbing. I didn't at first really set out to extract elements that I would assemble. I didn't have any idea what it was that I had, so I really had to listen to the full 8 hours a couple of times before I then started to, a story arc started to emerge, and certain milestones along her journey just kind of said, hey, you've got to put this in.
Was it, how hard was it to try and craft an arc, a story arc, out of someone's wrenching 8 hour year-long audio diary? I mean, you have a responsibility to produce a compelling program out of it, but at the same time, the material is very personal for someone else.
I dare say I felt more responsible to Dina than I did to putting together a good show. I really did. And maybe that's why it wasn't that hard to do, because there was a lot of heart involved in it. And I just put myself sort of in Dina's position as I was listening to this stuff. And the amazing part was that she had the instincts of a veteran producer, somebody who had been doing this her whole life. She chose the right things to record along that journey. I mentioned the milestones. She had all the right ones, and it just blew me away as I listened to it that she didn't miss things. And I think she says on the website, and you read this a moment ago, that it was those times when she feared the most that she knew she had to record. And those are in there. So they really did just, they begged to be used. She had set it up so well that it was very easy for me to put together.
Dina, your family appear in the program, in your audio diary. How did they feel about being part of this project?
They were wonderful. They were very, very supportive. My husband and I had talked about it initially before I even contacted Paul and Joe here at the station. So he was on board right from
That's
the beginning.
That's Joe Barr, the news director.
Yes, thank you. And my more extended family, some of whom you hear and some of whom you don't, in the final version, they were much more apprehensive about being taped. They did it sort of grudgingly and with a little bit of embarrassment. But they were very, very supportive in terms of my sharing my story, which is a big deal because it's a very personal story. And I felt lucky to have their support.
Dina Howard is a Sacramento woman who's a breast cancer survivor. For about a year, she kept an audio record of her treatment and reactions to it. That audio diary has been turned into an hour-long documentary that will be broadcast this evening at 6 and tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations. Also with us is Paul Conley of KXJZ News, who worked with Dina on the resulting program. Dina, let's listen to a clip of your husband, Ed, talking. This is at the beginning of chapter 2, I guess you could say, out of the 4 chapters of the program. And here he's talking about your first surgery.
So this is Ed, Dina's husband. And I'm going to tell you about what happened during the first surgery, because she's not really at a place where she can talk about this right now. So what was supposed to happen was that she was supposed to go in for a surgery of a single tumor, 5 to 7 millimeters in estimated size. But on the day of the surgery, during pre-op, they do this thing where they put the my wife in a mammogram, and they put a big wire into the breast, and the wire is supposed to inject something or other that helps the surgeon find exactly where the tumor is. But Dina's got a big needle phobia, and while she was in the mammogram and the needle sticking out of her, she fainted. So they had to do that procedure via ultrasound, and the radiologist who was doing the ultrasound finally found it after roaming around for a while, left and was gone a really long time. And she came back finally, and she said that they found what they thought was a second tumor. So we agreed that we would go forward with the lumpectomy that she was already scheduled for, but now have two tumors at least, rather than just one. But later on that evening, when I was in the waiting area, and her surgeon came down, Dr. Goodnight, and I looked up at him, and he looked like hell. And he sat next to me, and he said, put his arm around me, and he said, I'm sorry, there's a lot of cancer in there, and I didn't get it all. I didn't get it all, he said. And he said, she's going to need a mastectomy. So we went in thinking, you know, straightforward lumpectomy, but we left knowing that she'd have to talk to her surgeon real soon about, you know, let's be honest about it, I mean, it's an amputation.
Dina's surgeon, Dr. James Goodnight, joins us by phone. Dr. Goodnight, thanks for being with us.
Mr. Callison, it's very nice to be with you.
How do you prepare yourself to have conversations like that with patients and their families?
You never want to get too used to it. You never want to become glib, but you have to do it. You must communicate, and obviously you've got to be sympathetic to all of the issues.
You had a conversation you had many conversations, of course, with Dina, but there's one that appears in the program where you're discussing with Dina the difficult decision that's ahead of her. Can you tell us what you remember of that discussion and how, in general, you approach helping patients make the difficult decision about whether or not to have part of their body removed?
Obviously, it depends on what the indications and whether there are options. If they're truly options, you know, where you have a choice, then it's somewhat more difficult. We felt in Dina's case that we did not have a good option. It's always our preference to save the breast if possible, but you must be able to get around the tumor with the surgery, with the lumpectomy. And if you can't, then obviously then you must do the amputation. Women are quite resilient, as all of us are under fire, but it's a terrible loss and obviously a huge adjustment in how one sees themselves and thinks about things. So a lot of support and usually more than one conversation.
Dina, what was it like for Ed filling in for you there, talking on your behalf at this point of a dreadful realization? Sounded almost like he was whispering.
I think he was pretty emotional. That's why his voice is kind of deep and gravelly. He didn't like to talk on the tape. He's a much more private person than I am. I think it was difficult for him, but he was so incredibly loving through the whole process that really this is just one more example of him being supportive and stepping up to the plate. And he did it on so many occasions. It really was astounding.
You went on to have chemotherapy and radiation. Looking back over everything, what turned out to be worse than you thought and what turned out to be better than you thought?
Ooh. that's a hard question. A lot turned out to be worse because my diagnosis changed so dramatically. when you initially find out that you have cancer, especially, I think, at a young age, it's just shocking. Breast cancer is not something that's in my family, and it's not something that I ever really considered that I would have. So it was a big shock to get the initial diagnosis, but then an even bigger shock to get the news that my cancer was first of all a different kind of cancer than we had originally thought, and second, that it was much more extensive than we had originally thought. So that was probably the thing that was the most difficult. I remember having a conversation with my oncologist where I said, you know, do I need to write letters to my children? Am I going to survive this? And that was different than what I had originally been thinking about. And she said, yes, she said, you will survive it, that, you know, right now. No guarantees in the long run, but you will survive. But having to think about those things is quite shocking. What was easier was actually the actual process of doing the chemo and radiation. Both of them I found really frightening, especially the chemo. I found really terrifying. But really because of what it was more than how it was. Once you start to go to the chemotherapy, and this is in my piece, once you start to do it, and the nurse at my initial chemo talks about this, she says it's going to get easier, and it really does. It's not fun. I never liked it, but the sort of awfulness is diminished.
Dr. Goodnight, Dina's diagnosis went from moderately favorable, given, you know, the circumstances of breast cancer, to quite a bit worse. How common is that?
It's fairly uncommon. Part of it has to do is that she's young, and the hormone-sensitive tissue in the breast has the same density as the cancer. And so it was not very easy to see this cancer on mammogram. In fact, the second one wasn't seen on the mammogram. It happens less than 10% of the time, but it does happen, and it was painful for all of us to watch this unfold, to see it become, you know, clearly a much bigger cancer than we thought initially.
Dina, early in the program, when you're in Santa Barbara at the 2005 Thanksgiving, you're talking with your grandma Ida. It's a wonderful part of the program, and you talk about how you both like Oprah Winfrey, and I wondered, do you have any plans to share this program with Oprah Winfrey? Because you never know.
No, I don't. I would be thrilled if that were to happen, but that was certainly not in the plan. At that point, we actually hadn't told my grandmother about my breast cancer. She is almost 94 years old, and we have subsequently told her, but at that point we hadn't, and so I couldn't really tell her what the project was, and yet I wanted to get her to talk to me, and having her on that tape is quite wonderful for me, just to have her voice. She's a lovely person.
Let's listen to one more clip from Dina's diary. This is Dina talking with her son, Noah. And just so you know where we are, Noah's Sunday school teacher had breast cancer too. And so this flows from the conversation.
How's your Sunday school teacher?
She's really good.
And how am I going to be?
Good.
That's right. How about great?
Great.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Stupendous.
Stupendous.
Super delicious.
Super delicious.
How did Noah and your daughter cope with the year that just passed?
Surprisingly well. It was much more difficult on Noah, who was 6 when I was diagnosed, than it was on Maya, who was 2, because he clearly understood the ramifications better. He was more emotional and I think more scared. But they both handled it well. There were times when I was really down for the count, and I always tried to interact with them as much as I could, but there were times when I definitely was less than I would have liked to have been. Noah's friends were really great, and the parents of his friends, and his first grade teacher, Mrs. Jeremiah, was outstanding in terms of helping him and watching him. And something I just wrote for the website, because I find it really still shocking, is that my daughter, who is now 3.5, often still plays chemotherapy or the mommy has cancer with her dolls.
My goodness. And finally, Dina, how are you doing today?
I think I'm doing well. I'm starting to be less tired, which is wonderful, and feeling like I'm getting my life back, and pretty happy about that.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today, and best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
It's Dina Howard, along with Dr. James Goodnight and Paul Conley. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Goodnight, Dr. Goodnight.
Absolutely. It's fun to see you doing well.
Dina's diary airs this evening at 6 and again tomorrow at 2 on this station. This is Insight from KXJZ. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's no question which movie audiences most love this year, the mega-grossing Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. When it comes to the nation's movie critics, you probably hear more about modest or even minimally grossing films like The Queen and Letters from Iwo Jima. Today on Insight, we'll look back at the films of 2006. Our guests, movie critics Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee and Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review. Jim, Carla, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Carla, how do you think you'll remember 2006 as a year for movies? Is there a movie that comes to mind? Is there an adjective that comes to mind?
I would say how I remember it is that for the first time, I noticed that I really liked a lot more action-oriented films, and I didn't necessarily go toward the smaller films like The Queen, which I loved, but I had a greater appreciation for movies like The Departed and Inside Man, films that usually at the end of the year you forget about. But this year I just found a new appreciation for anything that completely engaged me.
Mm. And so is that part of a trend, do you think, or just a fluke that these action-oriented films were better this year than normal?
I think they were better this year than normal. I mean, a lot of years don't have Martin Scorsese doing a genre film like The Departed. But I think that what happened was I kind of kept expecting movies at the end of the year to eclipse the ones that I liked from earlier in the year, and they didn't necessarily do that. So I do think it's probably a fluke.
And what about you, Jim? How will you remember 2006 as a movie year?
Well, this may just be because Carl and I were talking about this as we came in, but I think I'll probably remember this as the year that Jennifer Hudson exploded into movies in Dreamgirls. It's one of the most astonishing, electrifying movie debuts since I don't know when. You have to go back to Orson Welles. It's an astonishing performance in a very good movie, but she's the whole reason to see it. And I think she's going to be a tremendous star. I can't believe she came in like sixth on American Idol. That's going to be right up there with the time Elvis Presley lost on Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour, I think. But I think I'll remember this as the year of Jennifer Hudson, and also the year of United 93, which I think was a movie entirely in a class by itself.
And we will get to that a little later. But first, I'd like to just quickly read through the current list of the top 10 grossing films of the year and hear what you two think about how the public did. Pirates of the Caribbean, Cars, X-Men, The Last Stand, The Da Vinci Code, Superman Returns, Ice Age, The Meltdown, Over the Hedge, Happy Feet, Talladega Nights, and Casino Royale. How did they do, Carla?
I would say they did fine with Casino Royale and Talladega Nights, both of which were really good for what they were. I am continuing to be perplexed, astounded, disappointed by Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and that is the top grossing movie of this year, given that it's not really a movie and that it doesn't really have an ending. It just sort of bridges the gap between two movies. And it's not it's not anywhere near as good as the first Pirates of the Caribbean, which itself was not fantastic. So I can't say that I'm, you know, necessarily disappointed in the public. I think that what happened is there's just Johnny Depp just has this incredible appeal, and it's a movie that you can take your kids to. And I think that that's a big, as you see, a lot of those movies are kid-oriented movies or PG or PG-13 movies. And I think that that's what fuels the box office is movies that people can take their kids to and enjoy themselves.
Jim, would any of those top 10 movies at the box office make your top 10 list of the year or even an honorable mention list?
Certainly several of them would. I'm with Carla on Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm not really sure what the appeal of that is. Even the appeal of Johnny Depp, I thought, was less this time around. I mean, he becomes like the drunk in the row behind you, making wisecracks at the screen. But several of the others, I thought Talladega Nights was great fun. Cars, I think, should be on anybody's top 10 list of the year. Generally, it's not a bad list. It's not a list to hang your head at. And I wouldn't want to stand at the theater shaking my finger at people coming out from having seen it. But I did think there were other better movies that probably didn't do quite as well with the public.
Let's talk a little bit about Cars. I literally saw Cars but didn't hear it. I was on an airplane and it was on, but my headphones didn't work. And interestingly, I sat there transfixed by the film. I kept watching it and had a pretty good idea of what was happening, even though I did not hear a word or a piece of music. Carla, did Cars match up to the amazing Pixar legacy?
I think it did. I think that, as with a lot of recent animated films, it's kind of the same story where a car or an animal gets separated from the pack and is kind of a loner and then learns about community. But the visuals are fantastic, and it has some really nice supporting performances. Like, you missed with Mater, the tow truck, was Larry the Cable Guy.
I guessed what his voice sounded like.
And also Owen Wilson, really, really perfect, just sort of the boyishness and the exuberance, perfect for the lead car. It's really silly to be talking about these cars, but I know that I found that the lead race scene in that film was incredibly exciting. And I found that what they could do with animation in terms of going to the shots of the wheels and those types of things, I just found it really, really well made. I don't think the story is always the strongest element of a Pixar film, but you just can't deny just the artistry of it. It's just great.
I think too that your experience with it, Jeffrey, gets to the heart of why Pixar is so good so much of the time, and that is the fact that they do tell visual stories. They don't go out of the way, for example, to brag about the stars that they have doing the voices as if they were actually in the movie, because they find the appropriate voices and that go with the look of what they've got. So many animated features nowadays play like illustrated radio rather than actual visual stories. And Pixar understands that it's what you see that carries the story rather than what you hear.
Maybe the most talked about film of the year was also designed to amuse, and that was Borat, starring and basically conceived by the British comedian Sacha Baron Cohen. Did it deserve all the talk or hype, Carla?
I think it did, most definitely, just because I find that it is the film that people want to talk to me about the most, and I can talk to them endlessly about it, and my opinion changes all the time. Well, it doesn't really change all the time, but I find that people feel more strongly about it than I do in terms of it being like a sort of a social commentary. But I just think it's very, very funny. I have problems with some of its methodology, as do a lot of people who are filing lawsuits. But I found it was deserving. I found it was a new way to go at a comedy. I haven't seen anything exactly like it. I mean, it has some echoes of Jackass and of other comedies, but the guy is brilliant. The guy is just on an acting level, that he does this sort of immersive acting in what had to be like one take. I think I just find it endlessly fascinating, the movie.
Jim, what do you think about the the controversy over how some of these people were filmed, it seems to me that if people knew what was going on and hung themselves, then that's their problem. But some of these people say that they were misled into what was actually going on. Do you think it matters if the end result is still funny and maybe even making a serious point?
Well, I really don't know how to answer that, because I can certainly see both sides of the argument. Some of the people who get skewered in this movie probably had it coming, and some people I felt were probably just standing in the wrong place when he felt like humiliating somebody. And so a lot of the humor in the film lost an edge. Well, it lost some of its humor because it was so edgy for me. There were some, you know, I didn't sit there harumphing all through the whole film, but at the same time, I wasn't convulsed with laughter either, because there was what Carla talks about, that element of jackass to it, that it did seem to be cashing in on either people's good nature or on their eagerness to do anything to be on television. Or in a movie, as this case was, it's not a movie that I'm really comfortable laughing at, it's not a movie that I can't deny that it's funny, because the guy, as Carla says, the guy will do anything for a laugh, but he seems to be willing to do anything to other people more than he is to do anything to himself.
Another controversial film was Apocalypto, the Mel Gibson film. Controversial because of the violence. I haven't seen the film. Is you two probably have. Is the violence too much? Does it undermine the film, Jim?
I don't believe that it does. I believe that it's entirely appropriate, because he is portraying a savage. I don't want to say a savage culture. I want to say he is portraying a savage, close to nature existence. That is, that's pretty much a kill or be killed situation. I don't think it was excessive, but it was not for the squeamish. That's certainly true. And I think much of the controversy surrounding the film came out of the more regrettable facets of Mel Gibson's private life. I'm still thinking about Borat. But I thought as violent as it was, it was more intense. And I think people are reacting to the intensity of it more than they are to what's actually on the screen in terms of blood and gore.
Well, Carla, when we think about Mel Gibson's films that he's directed, Braveheart, Passion of the Christ, Apocalypto, there is disturbing, grotesque violence in all of them. At what point does that become a problem as an audience member? Even if you can accept it in one film, does it start to become too much and you start to question this person's judgment? I'm not saying one should, I'm just asking.
I think that you can't. You have to separate all of those things. You have to even separate the past movies. You can see that there is something, it is in some way a reflection of his psyche that these movies are so tremendously violent. And I thought Apocalypto was far less violent than The Passion of the Christ, and at least it wasn't all in close-ups, and there were some longer shots, at least in Apocalypto. But I just think that you have to take every movie on its own basis. And this one had, the thing I really liked about Apocalypto is, unlike so many movies and recent movies, it didn't use sort of a Western white protagonist to offer context for the story about Native people. It just immersed you right in with those people, and you just went from there. And it was, I found it just incredibly, especially the chase scenes were just very, just really engaging. So I think that it's, although it's difficult, you just have to consider every movie on its own rather than as a whole. But it's so apparent that there's some things going on there with the violence.
A couple of other films that had people concerned, perhaps going in, were the two films about 9/11, United 93, and World Trade Center. Jim, you mentioned United 93. You really liked it. Were you concerned going in?
Not really. Mainly because I was familiar with Paul Greengrass's work from having seen Bloody Sunday, the one he did about the troubles in Belfast. Yeah. So I was familiar with his method of working, and he didn't strike me then as an exploitive filmmaker. And I felt that he might be exploiting 9/11 as he might have, or as some who weren't familiar enough with his work might have been concerned. I wasn't worried about it going in, and as the film progressed, I became even less worried about it, and actually more deeply moved than I expected to be, and I thought I was prepared for that.
Well, for what it's worth, I thought it was one of the greatest films I've ever seen. I was I expected it to be good, and was just absolutely blown away by how sensitive and yet dramatic it was. What did you make of it, Carla?
You know, actually, when I go back and think about it, even in the, I don't know, 8 months since it was released, when I was thinking about it for my top 10 list, and every time I think about it, it makes me so emotional just to even think about the film. And I can think of very few films that do that. And I think that what it will be looked at, I think that history will show that it's a very important film. And because I think what it does is it takes you back to that very moment, and you forget about what has happened since. It takes you back to that very moment when everyone felt that whatever was needed to be done in order to fight terrorism, the sort of the United States was completely joined together. And since then, that has changed, but it sort of takes you back viscerally to that moment. And it's just a real testament to the bravery of these particular people. And it's, I think that it will, history will show that it was a great, great, great film.
And you, to just to make sure it's clear, you believe that it is the artistry of the filmmaker that inspires these emotions and not just the connection to these horrible events.
Oh, definitely. It's the artistry of the filmmaker, because it plays out in such a natural way, and he has a great empathy for everyone. He doesn't even really demonize the terrorists per se, and I think that the way that it is handled, with some real people sort of reenacting what they did on that day, it's very straightforward. There is not a whole lot of jingoism, which was sort of associated with that flight at the time, and I have trouble with it just because it makes me so emotional when I think about it. But it was it's a hard movie to watch.
It is indeed. What about World Trade Center, Carla?
No.
Didn't like that one.
No, I didn't dislike it. It was just a very different approach in taking these real life people, and I think that it was very well done. It was very respectful. I think it was really well acted, especially by Michael Pena and by Maggie Gyllenhaal. But there was just something a little bit too sentimental about it, and I know that's unavoidable in this when you're speaking of this subject matter.
But United 93 wasn't sentimental.
It wasn't sentimental. But you know, you don't realize it as much until you compare the two films, because you know they're both good on their own, but United 93 is really exceptional.
Jim, World Trade Center?
I'm sorry, I can't speak to that. There were projection problems at the screening that I attended, and frankly, it didn't stay around long enough for me to get back to see it again. So although the screening broke down about the time the second tower collapsed. So in other words, about the time the film is actually getting underway.
I see.
I didn't see it. There was that sense that this was happening to Nicolas Cage, you know, and Maggie Gyllenhaal, much the way we look at old World War One movies, World War Two movies now with John Wayne and Errol Flynn. So there was that sense of this happening to movie stars,
which star
was not, yeah, which was not going on in United 93, even though there were actors I recognized.
Yes.
And again, I don't want to I don't want to offer that as a in any sense as a disparagement for a film that I didn't even, for that matter, see. But there did seem to be that element to it at the time that I didn't, that made it a separate experience from seeing United 93.
As you get into the film, it becomes less about you noticing that Nicolas Cage has a mustache, and it's more about the characters. But I think that what happens with Oliver Stone, that he's so used to doing being much more of a muckraker, being much more controversial, that he removed himself almost too much. And I think because I actually met the real life people to whom this happened, and they're wonderful people. And I think that anybody who meets them is touched by them. And I think that that might give you too much of it's almost too reverential. And that is a natural thing when you're dealing with the subject. And so I don't think that it is Oliver Stone's best approach. I don't think it is what he does the best is to do something reverential. Again, it's hard not to be, though, when you're dealing with this subject matter. And it is an incredible story that he's telling. It's just that with United 93 is just so much more involving. And a lot of it has to do with the subject matter with World Trade Center. A lot of it is these two guys stuck below, which is not an active thing, whereas a lot of it's, United 93 is very active.
Just very quickly, Jim, do you think the fact that United 93 was directed by a British film director, thereby making it one step removed from the United States, do you think that helped?
Well, it may have, but I think it had less to do with the fact that he was British than it did with the fact that he was Paul Greengrass. Because I think he had the same kind of empathy for all of the participants in Bloody Sunday. You didn't get the feeling that you were at some kind of agitprop filmmaking.
Yes.
You had a sense that you were actually there in the middle of it, literally, basically caught in the crossfire as it's actually happening. And that's the same kind of feeling that he was able to achieve with United 93. Whether that has more to do with his artistic personality than with his cultural roots, I couldn't say. But I think it was the fact that it was Paul Greengrass more than the fact that he was British.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more on the movies of 2006 with film critics Jim Lane and Carla Meyer. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today we're looking back at the movies of 2006 with film critics Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee and Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review. We've got a couple of clips from films lined up, specifically of actors, two people who've been talked about a lot as likely candidates for the best actor and best actress. And we'll start with Helen Mirren, who plays Queen Elizabeth II in the film The Queen. I'd like to hear what you think about Helen Mirren and The Queen, but let's listen to Helen Mirren.
How nice to see you again, Mr. Blair. Please do sit down. Have we shown you how to start a nuclear war yet?
No.
Oh, first thing we do, apparently. Then we take away your passport and spend the rest of the time sending you around the world.
You obviously know my job better than I do.
Yes, well, you are my 10th Prime Minister, Mr. Blair. My first, of course, was Winston Churchill.
The Queen is a dramatization of real events that happened just after the death of Princess Diana. Carla Meyer, what do you think about Helen Mirren and The Queen?
I think The Queen is pretty extraordinary just in that it does seem so real. And I know that it is a fictional script, but I know that the writer, Peter Morgan, had a lot of access to sort of insiders, and I'm assuming from Tony Blair's end, not the Queen's. But I think that Helen Mirren is just, it's such a wonderful performance because it's so easy to just parody the Queen and Queen Elizabeth II, and she doesn't do that. She finds what all she finds what there is about her that you can relate to, and that is being a mother, being a grandmother. I mean, not necessarily happy about her children, happy about her grandchildren, but that she feels this tremendous responsibility as truly, you know, a born leader to her country and to the British people, and thinks she knows them better than anyone. And it is a sad realization when she, in a truly almost tragic one, when she realizes that she doesn't, she's not really feeling the pulse of the country in the days just after Princess Diana's death.
Jim?
I would say it was an astonishing performance, except that I've come to expect nothing less from Helen Mirren. I think she's not a physical match for the Queen. She's too young. She's too tall. She's too, meaning no disrespect to Her Majesty, she's too sexy. And yet, in the film, she is Elizabeth II to the life. A lot of it has to do with the superb script. I don't know how much access this fellow had to insiders, but it has the ring of truth in every frame. I mean, right down to her muttering "bugger it" when her vehicle breaks down in the middle of the Balmoral estate. But she seems to have, people talk about the royal family sometimes as human flags. And she had that quality, the quality of the human flag, and yet she showed us the woman underneath, shall we say, underneath the Union Jack. It was a really amazing performance that I think when Oscar time comes around, I think she'll certainly be one of the few they're talking about.
Another person that's being talked about, although he appeared in a film that did almost no business, it's Forrest Whitaker, playing Idi Amin in the film The Last King of Scotland. Idi Amin, of course, was the dictator of Uganda. And in this clip with Forrest Whitaker, he's talking with a Scotsman who's visiting him in Uganda.
Who are you?
Nicholas. I'm Dr. Nicholas Garrigan. I work at the medical compound in Magambo. I'm a doctor.
You are British.
Well, I'm Scottish. Yeah, I'm Scottish.
Scottish?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say so? I fought with the Scots against the Mau Mau. Great soldiers. Very brave. And good people. Completely. Let me tell you, if I could be anything instead of a Ugandan, I would be a Scot.
Like, really?
Except for the red hair, which I'm sure is attractive to your women, but which we Africans, we find this quite disgusting. Thank you, Dr. Garrigan. A very good job.
Jim, what did you think about Forrest Whitaker? And is it possible to win an Oscar when your film does $3 million?
Well, it's possible. The only question I would have about this is exactly where to classify him, because although he has top billing, it is in fact a supporting role. Mm. However, it's happened before. Nicole Kidman won Best Actress for what was in fact a supporting role. So sure. it's not out of the question in terms of awards. But in terms of the performance, again, it's an astonishing performance. And Forrest Whitaker has been doing absolutely first-rate work and apparently getting no attention at all outside the industry. But he is very well respected among his fellow actors, and that could be enough to get him the Oscar for this one. He would certainly deserve it. It's a terrific performance.
And Carla?
I agree, it's a terrific performance. And also, I think what gets lost in all of the talk about the performance is that just a really good movie it is. I think it's a very exciting movie, and it's fictionalized, and it's a little nuts at times, but I found it really, really involving. And it to speak to the classification thing, this year it's bothering me a little bit more, not really so much for his performance, but with Meryl Streep being classified as Best Actress for The Devil Wears Prada when she's clearly a supporting player in that film. And I think more of this is happening, and it's just it doesn't seem like it's fair for the playing field. For
We just have about a minute left, okay. So we'll just very quickly. Do you think Martin Scorsese finally wins Best Director because of The Departed, which was a big success at the box office as well as acclaimed? Jim?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
It's possible because they are getting, as they, every year goes by, they're getting more and more embarrassed about that. But yes. But I don't think he will.
Carla?
I think he will, and I think it's sort of a shame because it's sort of like, Elizabeth Taylor winning for Butterfield 8. You think, well, what's it really for? But I don't see now anyone who is bigger competition.
Of all the films you saw that got an audience, which would you least recommend this year, Carla?
Which would I least recommend?
Yeah, the one that gave you the least pleasure. Well, while you think about that horrible thought, Jim.
Well, I have to say, I can't. Apparently, a lot of people shared my opinion, but I have to say, in terms of expectations or at least hope versus performance, I have to say the worst movie of the year was Lady in the Water.
Okay, and Carla?
I have to agree, Lady in the Water. Although I can't say I expected a whole lot from it, but it would disappointed me on so many levels.
Well, thank you both very much. Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee and Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review. Thanks both for coming in today.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the Secretary General of the United Nations steps down this weekend. Supporters of Kofi Annan say he's been a champion of human rights. Detractors say he did not do enough to stop genocides. That's the complicated legacy of Kofi Annan and the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes Technical Director Mark Jones, Assistant Producer Jen Picard, and Senior Producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thanks for joining us.